Oral History Resource Center, interview with Ben Margolis, April 15, 1980, by Greg Perkins.
Okay, I was wondering if you could describe a little of the background of your work in labor law previous to the Boilermakers case in Los Angeles.
Well, I started practicing law in 1933, and almost immediately, within a matter of months, became involved as an assistant in the Tom Mooney case, which was then pending in the Supreme Court of California, analyzing a record that had been made. And from that time on was more or less involved in labor matters and became a member of a labor law firm in 1936 and practiced labor law virtually exclusively in San Francisco until 43, and from 43 until about 49, did the same in Los Angeles, representing all of the CIO unions in the Southern California area and some AFL unions from time to time.
And the case that you became involved in the Bay Area in regards to the Jim Crow locals of the Boilermakers Union was called Jane versus Marin Ship. Could you go into some of the issues that were involved there and how they were perceived in the case?
Well, the issue was really a very simple one. The Boilermakers Union had two locals in the Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland area. One was an all-white local, the other all-black, or what we called them a Jim Crow local. And while I was still in San Francisco, I know I entered into some discussions and did some work in connection with the litigation that ended up in the Supreme Court a couple of years later as James versus Marin Chip, which attacked the concept of the two locals on the ground that it constituted a denial of equal protection of the laws. And one of the questions was whether this was governmental action or was private action over which the government had no control.
And how was the AFL involved in this suit? If it was directed against the corporation, were they also named as defendants?
Yes.
Okay. And what was the attitude of the Boilermakers Union towards this case? Were they at all conciliatory?
They defended it vigorously.
Mm-hmm. How did they try to defend their actions?
Well, they made the legal argument that there were no constitutional rights involved, and that, as a matter of fact, as I remember their argument, and you must keep in mind that it's a lot of years ago, but as I remember their argument, they tried to turn the tables on us and said that they were the ones who were fighting for constitutional right of freedom of association, that they had a right to associate with whoever they wanted to associate. And if they didn't want to associate, that blacks didn't want to associate with whites, and whites didn't want to associate with blacks, that was their business and was constitutionally protected. We argued, on the other hand, that this didn't apply, even if it did apply to private social clubs, did not apply to a situation where a person's ability and right to work in an industry where, particularly where the government had so many contracts, that principle didn't apply and that it was a denial of equal protection. We showed also under the fact, and I don't remember the details now, that as a practical matter, the black who remembers as Jim Crow local were discriminated against in their job opportunities, and particularly, as I recall it, with respect to promotion.
How did the other segments of the labor movement react to this? Did they get involved to any extent? The CIO, for instance?
No. The CIO, as such, well, this was 1930. This was 1943. The CIO wasn't in existence at that time. I think, when was it organized? About 45? As I remember, 45, 46, around there, that although there was some movement prior to that, there really wasn't a CIO as such prior to about 45. So there wasn't any CIO. There was just an AFL, and it did not participate, as I recall, in one way or the other. If you want to hold it a moment, I'll check to see who appeared in the case. Joseph A. Padway and Herbert S. Thatcher were attorneys for the National AFL, as well as for the Boilermakers. Well, I don't think that they were regular attorneys for the Boilermakers. They came in on this case. Clarence E. Todd. Let me see if I can get that straight. I was wrong. Here's what happened. The Boilermakers had their own local council represent them. And Padway and Thatcher and Todd came in as amicus curiae on behalf of the Boilermakers, so there was AFL support for the Boilermakers' position. Whether or not it was openly done as AFL support, I don't know. We, on the other hand, our firm, appeared on behalf of individuals, Arthur Garfield Hayes, Osmond Frankel, many other people. I'm just looking here for names that today might mean a great deal. Kerry McWilliams, A.L. Weir. We were representing the civil libertarian group in that litigation, as well as the workers.
Okay. And how did the final resolution of this case affect the labor movement? Did it have effect outside of just the Boilermakers Union?
I would say yes, although I can't give you the specifics. The fact of the matter is that within a short time thereafter, I think that Jim Crow locals disappeared all over the country.
Mm-hmm. And specifically in the Boilermakers Union?
Oh, yes. Well, I came to Los Angeles in 44. And at that time was involved in litigation on behalf of the Southern California group. And the decision that outlawed Jim Crow locals was from the San Francisco case, but it was applied in Southern California.
Mm-hmm. And could you describe what kind of group of workers were involved in the suit against the... It was against both the union and the company here.
Yes, well, it was not the officers, but the members, a group of members of the black local.
Mm-hmm. And were these people who had just recently arrived, or were they people who had just migrated into the Los Angeles area during the war years? How would you characterize them, their social background?
I don't remember the details, but you are going to be talking, I'm told, to Walter Williams, who would really know much more than I know about that.
I see. Okay. And later on, you were also involved in a case with Walter Williams that dealt with the unemployed 500 in the longshoremen's union.
Well, at that time I was representing International Longshoremen Warehouseman's Union Local 13,
mm-hmm.
which is the San Pedro, the longshore local of the ILWU. And Walter Williams was associated with a group, the so-called 500 unemployed, who had been registered on a tentative basis during the war. The ILWU sent people to work out of a hiring call, so they worked on different ships all the time,
mm-hmm.
and you had to be registered in order to have preference of employment. And during the war, there were temporary registrations, and after the war, these 500 were deregistered. As I recall it, not at all sure my recollection is accurate, about 420 out of 500 were black. I'm not sure about that number, but I know the great majority were black. That I'm positive of.
Mm-hmm.
And they filed an action for the deregistration, claiming that simultaneously with their deregistration, white sons of longshoremen were being registered. And I represented the union in that and recommended a settlement, which was eventually accepted and which resulted in the 500, or at least those who desired it, being given full registration.
Mm-hmm. During the war years themselves, how would you compare the attitudes of the ILWU to the Boilermakers Union as far as black recruitment and black membership?
Well, the ILWU, prior to the war,
mm-hmm.
was almost 100% white. That is, as far as Local 13, the longshore local. If there were at the most one or two blacks, but that was the general picture in any place you turn in Southern California, or most places. During the war, there was a large influx of black workers from other sections of the country, and the difference between what the Boilermakers did and what the longshore did is that in longshore they were accepted into the union and given this temporary registration and had full union rights in a single local that had blacks and whites and all others in it, whereas the Boilermakers set up the Jim Crow local, and that was, in my opinion, a very important difference.
Mm-hmm. So then the ILWU was basically sympathetic to providing jobs for black workers and bringing them into the labor movement. Would you say that?
I would say that prejudice against blacks at that time existed throughout the labor movement, including the ILWU. But it was, two things were true so far as the ILWU is concerned. One is that there was less prejudice than there was in other areas among the rank and file. And second, and very important, is that the leadership, the international leadership of the ILWU, were vigorous opponents of any discrimination. So that the whole atmosphere in the ILWU generally was different than it was in other sections of the labor movement. But nevertheless, there was still a great deal, among individuals, a great deal of prejudice.
Mm-hmm. One of the major themes that I found in the Longshore Union's newspaper, the Dispatcher, was the anti-fascist struggle during the war. And they kept saying that the fifth columnists in this country were trying to use race prejudice to split the country and defeat it. Do you think that that was the main reason that they were concerned with the question of racial discrimination, or do you think that they there was more genuine interest in black civil rights.
I think that that was one important reason. You remember that at that time the progressives and the left in this country were 1,000% behind the war effort and were against anything that weakened the war effort. But independently of that, the leadership and a large number of the rank and file of the ILWU were opposed to discrimination as a matter of principle. But I wouldn't say that the war thing was a ploy. It was real. They really felt that way about it.
So when the post-war economic slump came and the troops returned to this country and reoccupied their former positions of employment, do you feel that the leadership of the ILWU genuinely wanted to protect the jobs of the black workers?
Yes, they genuinely wanted, particularly in the international, they genuinely wanted to protect. And there was an interesting kind of a contradiction that raised the problems, and that was that the ILWU was, if not the most democratic, certainly one of the most democratic unions, and one of the elements of the democratic unionism was a strong support of what's called local autonomy, of the right of each local to decide its policies for itself. On an international level, there was total support for the fight against discrimination. On a local level, and particularly where men felt their own jobs or those of their sons were in danger, some of the people prejudiced to begin with, others not really prejudiced, but concerned about themselves and their families, you had a somewhat different attitude, and the question arose to what extent the international would give up its principle of local autonomy and interfere in local affairs for the purpose of protecting the rights of minorities. I think it is fair to say that what the international did was to use its influence to attempt to prevent discrimination. You tried to persuade, but I think with one exception, if I remember correctly, involving a Sacramento local where they moved in, they never did interfere with local autonomy. And there were some people who criticized the international for that, but it was a very difficult problem of a conflict between two very important principles to the international.
I've been told by different people involved in the Longshore Union Local 13 in San Pedro that there's always been a tradition of independence from Harry Bridges and the international leadership there. Did that have any effect on the attitude towards this issue of racial discrimination?
Well, I would say that that existed pretty much throughout the most locals, perhaps more strongly in Los Angeles than elsewhere. But their independence was in political areas and generally non-trade union areas. There isn't any question that in Los Angeles as well as elsewhere, almost, well, with rare exceptions, the strong support existed by the rank and file for what the international did. But when you got into an area like this, then not only here, but in other areas, there was a problem. And there always will be when people fear for their own jobs.
Mm-hmm. You did mention that there was significant difference in the response of the leadership of Local 13 and the response of the
rank-and-file membership of Local 13 to this case of the Unemployed 500.
Yes, originally, as I recall it, the executive board voted against the settlement, which I had worked out, which resulted in the reinstatement of registration of the 500. And then, under the, again, the democratic procedures, the decisions of the executive board had to be, could be disapproved by the membership. And the membership, by either unanimous or close to unanimous vote, disapproved of it and voted for the settlement.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe in a little more detail what the terms of the settlement were?
Well, it was simply that these, you see, some of the 500 had left and gone, some had gotten other jobs, but under the terms of the settlement, all of the 500 who desired it received permanent registration, which meant that they were placed in, from the standpoint of job protection, in the highest level, along with other members who were registered.
I see.
They had filed for a claim for damages, but it was really very secondary to them, and they did give up that claim for damages.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Walter Williams comes up in both the instance of the Boilermakers Union and of the International Longshore. And I wonder if there was a sort of social activism involved among some of these people around the black members in the CIO that transcended just the, you know, boundaries of trade unionism in the shop.
There certainly was, and Walter Williams was a leader among them.
Can you make any comments about the type of work or activity that they were involved in?
Well, it's difficult at this time for me to recall what any particular group was doing at that time, but I know Walter Williams was involved in many things, whether through that group or other groups, I don't remember, but certainly there was the fight against discrimination in our labor unions, the fight against Jim Crow, a very important battle that was going on at that time in the courts, so was the fight against restrictive covenants, the importance of which was great then, but not difficult to understand at this time. And as I remember it, against police brutality and against minorities and various things of that kind. Some instances there's been little change.
Mm-hmm. So just the fact that President Roosevelt opened, and some of the labor movement opened avenues for these black workers to get employment, didn't necessarily resolve other social issues in the black community.
Oh, by no means. They aren't even close to resolve today. But one shouldn't underestimate what was accomplished. Certainly, doors were a little bit opened that had been totally shut before. And they remained more open than they had been before the war. It never went back, at least in Southern California, to a situation that was as bad as existed before the war. That doesn't mean that there weren't many, many problems and that there wasn't discrimination in virtually every area of life that continued.
Mm-hmm. But you would say that the people who were involved in opening the job opportunities in these war industries during the war became significant figures in trying to deal with these other social problems in their communities.
That is true.
You just don't have very much first-hand information on that.
Well, my my work was primarily in the legal arena,
mm-hmm.
and I had contact with a lot of people, and knew at that time what was going on, but a lot of water is going under the bridge. It's we're talking about a period that is 40 years ago. Oh, no, not 35. 30 to 35 years ago, and my memory just doesn't hold up on a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One other thing that I was curious about is that this conflict of seniority versus protection of recently won jobs by blacks still persists today, and I was wondering if what happened after the case of the unemployed 500 in the Longshore Union? What was the...
Well, you see, the case of the Longshore 500 really did not constitute a breakdown of the seniority rule because a principal ingredient in the whole picture was the fact that new longshoremen were being registered. And it wasn't a situation where anybody had to lose a job in order to have a black person with less seniority replace that person. That's where the problem has arisen and still exists, where a white worker, let's say, has 15 years of seniority, and a black worker who should have been working in the industry for 20 years, but has been denied that right and has sort of by justice, a seniority of 20 years, but no actual seniority at all, whether that worker can replace the worker who's worked for 15 years and has acquired 15 years of seniority. That's the tough one.
Mm-hmm. Was the system in the Longshore Union, I think it's referred to as sponsorship, where a work card or workbook would be passed down through the family. Did that continue to persist, and did the blacks eventually benefit from that themselves?
Yes, it continued to persist for a number of years, and some blacks did benefit from it. However, there was a labor board case. It's hard for me to remember how long ago it was, maybe 10 years ago, and I'm just guessing about that time, which resulted with that system being done away with as being an illegal system. Whether or not it in some form or in some way prevails today, I don't know. I kind of doubt it.
What was the attitude of the black members when their turn came up to begin sponsoring people as the white dad, and suddenly the system came under attack? How did
they wanted the same rights that the whites had. You see, the theory of the whites is that a person has a kind of a property right in his job. And just as you can pass down other property rights to your children, if you acquire some money or a house, you can pass that on to your children. You've worked for them, you've earned it. They say, well, I've given my life 30 years to this industry, and I have a stake in this industry, and I ought to be able to pass that down to my son, just as I can pass my house that I acquired down to my son. And you can't just throw that argument out completely from the standpoint of the workers. It has some merit to it. The problem, of course, is a fundamental problem that arises out of the nature of the system that we have, under which there isn't full employment for everybody. If there was, this would be a much more logical argument.
Okay. So, do you feel that in the final analysis, the blacks wound up losing something by the fact that this system was declared illegal, or?
No, I think not. I think this is evidenced in part by what has happened to the composition of the law. So I'm not right up to date on it, but I think a few years ago, the fact were that this local, which say before World War I was 99.44% white, had about a third whites, a third Chicano, and a third blacks, which is pretty indicative of the fact that the door was open, and in that instance it worked pretty well. I think that the percentage of blacks